Boy, I guess it'd have to be a combination of Socratic and I don't know what else. A Socratic, Gandhian, and Saint Francis, because he could be a tough taskmaster, he could be a gentle teacher, he could be a thoughtful preacher, and all of it usually teaching from the same vision, but different trunks of the same vision, wherever it was. He didn't deviate, because his world was his life was his world, and the things he taught, whether it was about farm workers or about treating people, was always the same. And a big example of that is that he really got a lot of us to be clear about one thing. And I think this is very important over time to understand about him and his teachings, is that he was the best, what we would call today, diversity teacher. He was the best inclusive teacher. He was the best at letting people know who worked with him that it's never about race. It's about people, and it's about more about class than race. But he made it very clear that those who were surrounding him, you couldn't work with him if you had a problem with a certain race. You couldn't work with him if you had a problem with gender, a problem with sexual preference, or whatever you want to call it. You couldn't work with him, because he was wide open at a time when people weren't wide open about those things. And so he really, you know, it's interesting to me as you look back, because since his passing, people, I think, you know, it's sort of a natural tendency, but people think that so much of his life, even though he's a great Latino example, and he's a great example to Latinos, people thought his life, rose and fell mostly among Latinos, and that's a misconception, because more of the people, and this is really, looking back in retrospect, it's very surprising, that far more of the people, for whatever reasons, that he attracted and who worked with him, were Anglos and African Americans and, you know, some Asians. And so he was able to do it so that even though he would make sure people understood those lessons, like, for example, he used to praise the Coca-Cola Minute Maid workers in Florida, who were, I think at one point there were several thousand of them, and they were 95%, about 95% black. And he praised them because they understood, and he gave them, reinforced the lesson that when they had their negotiating team, it was important for them to have one of the 5% also on the negotiating team. Things like that. Or the diversity was so rich that when you had mostly African-American members in Florida, I remember flying into Avon Park, into a little dirt airfield there once, and there are all these cars with Huelga flags. The only thing that was different, when you got out and they were saying Viva Cesar Chavez, they were all black. And so that ability to bring people and races together was really uncanny, and it was unprecedented at the time, I think, because he had such a diverse, he was dedicated and devoted to his constituency, which a lot of people who are theoretical activists don't have to do. And so his constituency was so wide that he had Okies, and he had the original base of Filipinos, and then he had a lot of Mexicans. And then he had, in different times, a lot of Arabs from Yemen, a lot of Arab members who were the same about Viva Chavez as the African Americans in Florida were. And then he had Hindus, and he had Sikhs, and he had, every kind of group that worked in the fields, Portuguese, the Gallo workers, many of them were Portuguese. So you had all these, and he would do things way back then that would cater to them in a United Nations smart way. Things he learned in his travels in Florida and in Canada, where he would see everything done bilingually, he would make sure that where necessary, where needed, where important, his movement would reflect that as well. So you'd always have things. Maybe meetings would go longer, but he always had translations. He didn't, very seldom did he have the ability or the resources to have simultaneous translation, which he did incorporate at times in big conventions. But most of the time you'd have, if it was Portuguese or if it was Arab, whatever it happened to be, he'd have people translating, and he'd have Jewish organizers working with the Arab farm workers because he brought people together, didn't pull people apart. So that was one of his real powers, and I think certain kinds of nationalists from any point of view had problems with him that way. But I always like to point out that there were really, and who knows what the reasons are, it doesn't matter what they are, but there were very few Mexican-American Latinos on the Great Boycott or Farm Worker Union staff by comparison to the Anglos who were there. And there was a great mix, but it was part of the power, his power of persuasion and influence and example that brought people to him, and they didn't matter where they came from or what color they were or what their beliefs were.
Now, Richard, one of the things that you just hit on was this whole the power of example, and how was that reflected in Caesar's style of working with people and teaching people?
I think with one notable exception in the makeup of the people who worked with him is that so many of us or so many of them, had in our fervor, were great warriors but weren't great peacetime people. And so it was hard to come to a screeching halt when we'd have a settlement with the employers. So you had people who were really adamant in heading in one direction, and it was hard to turn back on that. Could you rephrase the question one more time?
Yeah, we talked a little bit in previous conversations a little bit about how Caesar was a teacher who showed and didn't necessarily tell that he led by example. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that with that notable exception I mentioned about people being so adamant and doing their work with such great fervor in battling what they we saw as an injustice, real or perceived at the time, that with that one notable exception, everybody who worked with him would somehow, by choice or if they just wanted to be there, usually by pretty much personal choice, want to follow some kind of that example. And you wanted to show him you were doing good work. You wanted to do the work in the way he did. So many times, even with the variation of personalities and styles, as we went around the country and had leaders in the movement speaking or introducing Caesar or doing their part in their region or their state or their city, so many of them delivered the same message as he did because they saw him do it, they watched him do it. He coached them without telling them how to do things. And as they traveled with him, they would get better and more confident in what they did because he had a lot of people do things they never thought they could do at young ages with certain language limitations and others when they'd go somewhere with no money and five names to contact in the city and suddenly be expected to, and a year or two later, build this great boycott network that was really the power that drove him to become a national figure, and I think got a lot of people interested in what he did, and it became that central focus and understanding of people when it came to who Cesar Chavez and the farm workers were. And I even look back at how I tell people during some of the immigration debates we've seen the last couple of years that there was a time when, because of Cesar and his work and the example he set and was carried out by those who worked with him, that America during those times inadvertently, and maybe didn't quite understand it then, every time they supported the Great Boycott of the Farm Workers Union, they were directly supporting immigration and immigrants, because that's who the farm labor force more than any other was forever and remains today. But he was able to get millions of Americans to say with their pocketbooks and with their feet that they voted by not shopping at a certain place or not buying a certain product, they voted to support immigrants. And that's maybe an overly simplistic way to look back at it, but it did happen at a time that was not dissimilar to now, but there was a different perspective, and you had him as a beacon training people and really by example, because once you'd watch him in meetings, he would be teaching all the time, but he wouldn't tell you he was teaching. But you, most of the people who worked with him paid attention, wanted to pay attention, and depending on their own skills and talents and intelligence, they would carry it out in their own way and style, but very similar. The vision and the message that he had and he taught would become theirs, not by osmosis, but by example.
Right. Now, in addition to being a teacher, Richard, I mean, did you talked earlier about the fact that he was an avid reader, but did you also see him somehow as a student, as someone who studied, not only read, but studied people, studied the world? I mean, can you talk a little bit about him being a student of life?
Yeah, I think that goes back to his innate curiosity about everything. And, you know, I think throughout his life he learned, no matter what his means were, resources were, to know what quality was. So he had good taste in what would be good for him or good for others. He always had a good eye for the things that were better or best in terms of products or services or results. And so he, as someone who saw those things, he would oftentimes find a way to influence others to see the world or similar value in the work they were doing.
Now, Richard, one of the things that really struck me that you were talking about a little bit earlier was the fact that here's a man for whom gender didn't get in the way, race didn't get in the way, sexual orientation didn't get in the way. I believe there's a story there about him going to a Harvey Milk Club meeting, and remember that incident at all?
Yeah,
how he handled that.
You know, I think to preface some of that is that Caesar recognized the dignity in others when others didn't recognize that same dignity. And so there are various examples over the years, but I don't know where he began to pick that up because I wasn't there, but as I traveled with him, I sure picked up that he was learning it and exercising it wherever he could have influence or have an opinion or affect others. And he did it in ways that, recalling the early in what we would call the more public gay movement, we had the Gallo March in 1975, I guess it was. And in 1975, there weren't many mainstream groups who invited or let gay groups speak at their events and rallies. I bet you'd be hard-pressed to name a lot of groups that did who weren't part of their own movement. And yet, when we had, I think, 15,000, 20,000 people in Modesto at this rally, and people from the, whatever it was, the Gay and Lesbian Liberation Group, or whatever the name of it was, several of them from San Francisco, the Bay Area, he gave them time on the platform without ever questioning, because they were there and they were part of him and part of his group. And I remember it was noteworthy because at the time, the people who were doing translation didn't know how to translate the name of the group. How do you translate it? How do you translate it? So people were giggling. Well, how do you translate this? Do you use a bad word? I mean, so it was of note because it was happening. And that would happen. That's one example. Or the other, maybe even more glaring example was, we all, looking back historically, will remember the group called The Move in Philadelphia. And The Move, that was a group in the early 80s who, in a house there in Philadelphia, they were sort of a counterculture movement, African Americans in Philadelphia. In the early 80s, the police chief or someone, bombed them and burned them up in this house there in a confrontation in the neighborhood. Well, they were around in the late 70s. In 79, that same trip I took with Caesar back east, one of the trips we went back there, we were at in Philadelphia, and we were in a church office. And there were glass walls, windows, you could see it around the office. And there was this group of African Americans with dreadlocks, and early form dreadlocks, because people didn't have many then. But they were a group called, and Caesar asked, "Who's that?" "Well, they're the people from The Move." "Well, who are they?" "They're this crazy group," someone told him. Okay, so who are they? And as someone else explained to us, they were a group that was very counterculture, and they prided themselves in not bathing and in cussing a lot in public, and they were just this militant sect of people, a rather small group, and they were all named Africa. And so Caesar said, well, let them in. They want to talk to me, let them in. So they came in, and Africa One, or whatever he's called, the leader, asked Caesar, in between his cussing and ranting, he asked if they could speak at his rally at a Methodist church later that evening. And Caesar says, sure, you can speak after me. No one, I believe, had ever told him yes about anything. And Caesar told him yes. And that night, we go to this giant church, and there were about 900 people in the church. And Caesar got through speaking at the end of the program, or towards the end of the program, and he said, I think the people from the move would like to speak. Well, the church emptied out, except for the 9 people in the move, within about 30 seconds. Everybody's gone because they knew what was coming. And the Africa One got up on the podium there at the front of the church and spoke for about an hour. Caesar was having a meeting in a back room. We were back there with about 30 volunteers who were going to work for him for $5 a week. Very interested in talking about it. And I kept peering out there to see Africa, who was cussing and ranting for an hour in this church. It was empty now, except for his 9 flag. They were all happy as a lark because someone told them yes, respected, recognized their dignity. He got to cuss for an hour in a church, and he was happy, and they were happy, and his followers were happy in the front row. And everybody, it was a no-lose situation. But that was what Caesar did with them, as opposed to the police chief a few years later who blew them all up and killed them all, because they had this different counterculture. So he was very open to other styles, especially open to other religions. And I've always thought that one of the real rare things about him as an American labor leader is that American labor leaders, on the natural, don't get invited to church groups. Probably their own church group doesn't often invite them to address or speak or to teach. And Caesar literally was invited to every church group you can imagine in this country, in Geneva, in Canada, in parts of Europe when we were there. He was invited to all these church groups, and they wanted to learn and know about him and his beliefs and what he could tell them about what they did. And they loved his message, and he was so well received, in temples and synagogues and, big synods of different churches. Every denomination you can imagine wanted him as a keynote speaker to those events. That is not what people do with American labor leaders. So he was very much a draw to those groups. They were very supportive of him, oftentimes and chronologically more supportive than his own Catholic Church at times, and they caught up later in different ways. But he had great relations within the Catholic Church, especially with the Franciscan order. He was sort of an unofficial Franciscan over time, and had a lot to do with them and the California missions. And even, he always had nuns and priests as part of the $5 a week staff, core staff, key staff, smart staff, discipline staff, focus staff, right. Staff that produced. And to that end, he always had priests that would lay down their lives for him, priests that would get in trouble. Father Victor Saladini, who I always said was, he was part of the, an order that answered to Jesus, but he followed a Caesar. And Father Victor really was probably the greatest example of someone who gave his life to Cesar Chavez and his movement anytime, day or night. And he was censured a few times in his own diocese of San Diego. And I knew him quite well. And in his deathbed, he gave me the honor of doing his eulogy after he passed. And we were discussing it when he was ill with cancer. And he died the same age as Caesar, oddly enough, 66. But Father Victor, I asked him how he had at a young age, he was a very, very young priest when he met Cesar Chavez in the early 60s. And I asked him, well, how'd you know about it? You were young, you were inexperienced, you didn't know that much. How'd you find this guy before the rest of the world, in a sense? He said, well, I had met at a social teachings event maybe in Minnesota, in the state of Minnesota. I met this brother Gilbert there, and I was telling him, you know, what I wanted to learn, and he said, well, you should meet this guy Cesar Chavez, who's in Delano doing some work there. And so he went there and asked him questions about the social teachings. Kenny said he was totally in line with what he believed as far as his role as a Catholic priest. Well, fast forwarded a few years later, Father Victor was arrested with Cesar early on and treated badly in Borrego Springs in the San Diego County Jail. But I asked him, I said, you know, Father, we're having a good, candid conversation. And I said, Father, you've done these things for us, like giving us a general absolution for many years. We don't have to go to confession, and we're Catholics. And he just says, hey, you know, hocus pocus, and you're okay. And I said, Father, who's going to be you? You break all the rules for us, for baptisms and homes and all these things without all the fancy paperwork. You do it for us, and you've taken care of us all these years. Who's going to be you? And he says, well, you know, we talked about that a little bit. I said, but how did you start doing that, Father? Because no one else does that. He said, well, I've been accused of breaking a lot of the church rules, but I've never really broken them. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, when I first started doing general absolution, I was with Cesar in Imperial Valley at a farm labor camp. And there were a couple hundred young Mexican workers there. And Cesar said, Father, can you do a mass for them? He said, yeah. He said, well, Father, some of them like to do confession. Well, he said, I was a young priest, so I did confession very slowly. So was there taking, you know, what seemed like hours, and it was getting dark. And Cesar said, Father, can you just do general absolution for all the workers here? And he said, I was a young priest. I said, Cesar, I don't think I can do that because only the bishop can give you permission to do that. And Cesar said, yeah, but the bishop's not here. So Father said, okay, at that time I decided, and ever since then I decided that the only time you can give general absolution is when people are in danger of their lives. Their lives could be endangered. He said, and I said at that moment, and every time I've done it since, that these people and the farm workers, as farm workers and the farm workers, their lives are at danger all the time, whether it's for pesticides or dangerous trucks or the picket lines. So I gave myself an okay to give general absolution because I knew they were in danger of death, and all of you were all these years, so that's why I was able to do it. So he gave me the little story, but that was part of the influence. But Cesar had many, many, many priests and nuns who gave a lot of us who had fallen away from the church a way back because we met the best the church had to offer. And Cesar really related well to them, the nuns, the women religious group. They were so powerful allies of his over the years. They were teachers. They taught him. And you talked about learning. He learned from all of those groups. He learned from all of his experiences. He learned from all the readings. He learned from the pamphlets he'd pick up from those groups. He read their histories, and he learned and learned and learned. So he got the lessons right and tried to apply them where he could to his own vision, focus, and discipline.
Now, Richard, I want to transition a little bit. We're exactly where I go.